From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at the sharp decline in Milwaukee's unsheltered homeless population and some of the COVID-19 measures that helped. Then we'll hear from a Milwaukee yoga teacher who's working to make the practice more inclusive.
Newer students come in like, you know, I've been looking for a Black yoga teacher. I didn't even know you existed in Milwaukee. So when they find us, it's almost like this sense of like disbelief and relief.
Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton shares some ways to appreciate this week's full moon.
If you do spend the time to slow down a little bit and watch it day in and day out, you see the subtle differences, you see the changes, this changes in color.
And Bubbler Talk explores why Milwaukeeans love cheese, sausage, mushroom, and onion on their pizza. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. First, over the last year, Milwaukee has had a record decline in the number of people who are homeless and living on the street. The decline is bucking the national trend, which saw homelessness rise during the COVID-19 pandemic. As of the point in time count this January, there were just 17 people living unsheltered in Milwaukee County. Advocates say the decline is thanks to greater collaboration among groups fighting homelessness and measures put in place during the pandemic, which they'd like to see continue. Joining me now is Nancy Estevez, the HMIS System Administrator at the Institute for Community Alliances, as well as Eric Collins-Dyke, Assistant Administrator of Supportive Housing and Homeless Services for Milwaukee County. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Right now, what does homelessness in Milwaukee look like?
You know, I think during the summer months, you know, it always gets busy for the outreach teams on the street. We tend to see more individuals outdoors as the weather gets warmer. So it's definitely our busy time of the year for our outreach team and the other outreach teams in the community. Working at the county, we get a lot of constituent calls or through county supervisors about sort of the perception of homelessness, right? Like the aesthetics of it. People just see it driving by. And I want to keep hammering home that individuals and families experiencing homelessness in our community are our community members. They are our neighbors, and treating them with dignity and compassion and I think transparency is huge. I think one advantage that we've had compared to other years is over the winter and during the height of COVID last year, there was quite a few resources that came to the table that we didn't have before in terms of funding that was used for hotels. And so we were able to utilize those hotels for close to 200 individuals, getting them off the street. And I think from the outreach perspective, it was a wonderful resource and one that we are hopeful that will continue on an annual basis. It's such a dignified approach in terms of being able to give those we serve a room with a shower, a TV, a clean bed. So yeah, like right now it's busy for sure, but a little less busy than years past due to some of the resources that we've had over the last year.
So to clarify, the numbers that we're looking at right now, the data that we're looking at is based more on the winter, more during kind of the height of COVID to some extent.
Yeah, so the low on shelter count during the winter was in January, and it can definitely be attributed to the hotels and the other in the shelters and the other facilities that we used during that time to get people in that previous years we didn't have before. And so I think that coupled with the expanded outreach in the community, adding shifts during the day and at night, and I think the collective outreach community getting people in was really remarkable in terms of why the number was so low for the unsheltered side of things.
It is a pretty significant reduction. Nancy, when we're talking about these kind of point-in-time surveys, can you explain what those are for people who might not be familiar?
Sure. So the point-in-time is a snapshot. It's on this one specific day, how many men, women, and children found themselves experiencing homelessness. And by that, it's a very specific terminology. And so in order to be counted for the point-in-time count, you have to have been outside in a place not meant for human habitation, in an emergency shelter, or transitional housing. And so it's important to note that folks doubled up, or the terminology that's been tossed around is couch surfing, those individuals are not counted because they are not, they are experiencing homelessness, but not in an unsheltered way. Really, it's kind of like a, it's a litmus test. How are you doing in ending homelessness? What is your community doing? Are you really paying attention to the needs of the community? And how are you working collaboratively? And so really, it's important to make sure that you're not in these siloed situations where this shelter only takes care of this part of the community, and then this housing program only takes care of this specific population. And I really am fortunate and honored to be working alongside Eric and other outreach teams, the housing providers, shelter providers, because really they are looking at the bigger picture. They're looking at how quickly can we get folks off the streets into a safe and dignified situation, whether it be in a hotel, a shelter, or directly into permanent housing. Because let's be frank, not everyone is suitable for emergency shelter. And so we need to make sure that we are addressing the needs of the clients that we're serving and making sure that we are, that we're sensitive to their needs as well. And so the point in time really allows the outreach teams to go out, do the work that they're doing already, and that rapport that they've built, they go ahead and they interview folks that they've been working on a consistent basis. What they're doing is they interview, ask some demographic information. Most of these clients, they already have a relationship with. So it's really just a conversation. What's going on today? How do you feel? Are you safe? And what can I do to get you to tomorrow, right? Because it's a day-by-day situation. Today, they may need shelter. Tomorrow, it's a different situation.
Well, and that gets to a question that I certainly had looking at these numbers. Of course, point in time, as you've mentioned, is really just a snapshot. But this snapshot showed about 17 unsheltered people.
17 unsheltered, mm-hmm.
It does raise this question of why 17 people remain unsheltered when it's such a small number. Is it a lack of funds or resources, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we can always use more resources. I think as long as I do this work, I will say that all the time. There's never enough resources. 17 people outdoors is 17 people too many, in our opinion. It varies. You know, I was looking at our point in time list of spots we went throughout the county, and it's over 175. So we really tried with outreach community health centers, community advocates, the volunteer outreach teams. We tried to hit any conceivable spot where there might be someone or a group of people. There's not just the unhoused piece of homelessness. There's many layers to it. Individuals dealing with, you know, really intense trauma, mental health, other factors that sort of dictate their day-to-day, and they're in survival mode. And so I think, you know, we try to get the community to understand that surviving day-to-day when you're homeless is, yes, housing and shelter is a focus, but so is figuring out how to find food to eat, how to get, you know, from one part of the city to the other. And so I think until we look at the sort of holistic aspect of somebody dealing with homelessness, including the sheltered piece and the housing piece, you know, I think we're going to continue to face that there will be people outdoors. And my sort of plea to the community and to those who make decisions is that the stuff that was put in place during COVID because of the federal funding is something that I think we have to, as a community, look at moving forward. Not only as a baseline for what should be available to those in our system who need housing, but also to see if we can use that to get more dollars. I think, you know, now is the time. I mean, if there's any silver lining during COVID, it was that we got all of these resources. We came together as an outreach community. We had this dignified resource in the hotels. And so I'm just hopeful that we can continue to push for more of those.
Nancy, when you think about the things that were implemented during this pandemic that have really worked, I know you mentioned the hotels as being something that is really important. What are the variety of things that have been put in place that you'd like to see continue?
Prevention. I think that there's been this myth that says in order for you to obtain stable housing, you have to find yourself in an unsheltered or sheltered situation. So get out of where you're going and go to a sheltered situation. And really, especially with individuals with young, small children, we don't want folks to think that that's the go-to solution. Their CARES dollars, and because of the pandemic, as a result of the pandemic, there have been lots of dollars to prevent folks from even becoming homeless in the first place. As a community, we strive to make sure we don't, our numbers of first-time homeless, those that have touched the system for the first time, whether they touched it 2 years ago or they touched it now for the first time, we don't want them to continue touching our system. We consider it a success if we can keep individuals, families in their stable housing, as long as they're safe, continue to keep them housed. I think that that's an incredibly important piece. A second piece is in order to maintain housing, you need some really good supportive services. Supportive services are key. We have some great vouchers for permanent housing. Hotels are not the solution, right? It's just kind of like a stepping stone. What we need is long-term care. We need professionals to be able to work with clients in their housing to make sure, you know, it's that housing first model that we embrace. Get somebody housed. Then work on the obstacles that are keeping them from their housing stability. So it's case management. It's working with, you know, getting them connected. If it's mental health, with the mental health provider, medications, if it's something, of course, this is all voluntary, right? And so it's not, I think we've moved past that motto of you have to do X in order to receive Y. I think that that's a very dangerous way to navigate a system. Because, you know, if you have small children, it's the same thing. You can't always be manipulating that situation. You have to work with them. And so that they come to that decision on their own. And it's a healthy relationship, you know, establishing trust with a case manager, knowing that Eric is going to come and work with me day in and day out. And I know that if I have an issue, I trust him to communicate that issue with him without feeling that I'll be penalized for it. You know, and I think that because we've changed that model, we've been able to house more individuals.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, Eric, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy, for having us.
Take care.
Nancy Estevez is the HMIS System Administrator at the Institute for Community Alliances. And Eric Collins Dyke is the Assistant Administrator of Supportive Housing and Homeless Services for Milwaukee County. Astronomy buffs may know that a full moon will be appearing in the sky this week. Coming up in about 15 minutes, contributor Jean Creighton will talk about its bigger significance and some of the best ways to view it. But first, we'll hear from the owner of Embody Yoga and learn about her mission to make yoga more inclusive.
They come into this Black-owned and operated yoga studio and immediately feel at ease or maybe even at home because they can look around and they see people that look like them, that talk like them. They see a variety of shapes.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many people have picked up a hobby during the pandemic, and some have started new health practices, like yoga. People have turned to the ancient practice for the physical, mental, and spiritual benefits it can have. But the practice can feel exclusionary for some, and classes can be prohibitively expensive. Joanna Brooks set out to change that. She started doing yoga as a child, but it wasn't until adulthood, when she took up Bikram, also called hot yoga, that she truly found her calling. Brooks now runs Embody Yoga, a Milwaukee studio geared toward people of color that focuses on the practices of vinyasa yoga, a style that involves the flow between yoga positions. Brooks spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about her studio, and she starts by describing her journey to becoming a teacher.
You know, I don't give one teacher that I had early on enough credit. I don't even remember her name. This was at a Bikram hot yoga studio in Milwaukee. And she was a Black woman, natural hair, and I really enjoyed her classes. I would, you know, take her classes often. And it wasn't that, you know, I had a personal relationship with her. She was very much teacher and I was student. In fact, I think one time I like brought a friend or somebody to yoga class with me and we were kind of like giggling and whispering to each other in between poses. And she like asked us to be quiet. And so
she was serious.
Yes. But, you know, the way I felt at the end of class, and I don't know how to describe that, but I just felt so accomplished and my body felt so good and open and free. And so we would just lay there on the floor at the end of practice on our mats in Shavasana. And I just remember thinking like, I want to have this effect on people, you know, like I want to help people feel this way. I think I've always been driven towards career paths or work that put me in a position to serve other people. And so that's when I started to think about becoming a yoga teacher.
And really quickly, Shavasana, for people that don't know yoga, can you explain that a little bit?
Shavasana is a resting pose that we experience at the end of our practice, right? After you've done all of the work, you lie down and you just rest, right? And in my moment of rest in that particular class, it was almost like I had this epiphany or just a really strong desire to be able to offer a similar experience to people. And so I decided to consider yoga teacher training. Now, at that time, my only experience with yoga as an adult was Bikram yoga. And so naturally, I thought that I might become a Bikram yoga teacher. So I started to do the research.
And what's Bikram yoga exactly?
Yeah, so Bikram yoga is a style of yoga. It's a set series or sequence, 26 postures, 2 breathing exercises, and it's done in a space heated to about 105 degrees and a certain percentage of humidity. I'm not exactly sure. I don't remember what that percentage is. And so it's a really challenging, trying experience, right? Like you definitely learn something about yourself in the process of a Bikram yoga class. And so I thought that was the style of yoga that I might teach because that was what I had experience with as an adult. And so I started to look into the trainings a little bit more. And it was expensive. I believe at that time, like $8,000 or $9,000. And so I spoke to another teacher that I practiced with at this particular studio. And I shared with her that I was thinking about becoming a yoga teacher. And she surprisingly encouraged me to explore other styles of yoga just based on her experience. And then that led me to Vinyasa Flow, which is kind of, you know, what I settled on. And what I became certified in, Vinyasa Flow Yoga.
So yoga as a practice, it was created in ancient India, you know, over 5,000 years ago. But in the United States, it's sometimes associated with being skinny, white, and affluent. Can you talk about how that has affected you and how you're working to change that conception?
Yeah, you know, you go into, you know, pretty much any yoga studio and that's what you see, right? There's typically just white people, mainly women. And the cost of practicing yoga isn't really prohibitive for them, right? And you can see or assume that in like the mats that they carry, the really expensive yoga mats and really expensive yoga clothes and, you know, everything that can come along with a yoga practice, especially in the United States. And so, you know, for me, you know, fortunately, I was able to afford a membership at this particular studio, but I've always prioritized movement and wellness, you know, when it comes to, you know, setting a budget for myself. But when I thought about who I wanted to serve or who I thought needed access to the practice of yoga, and considering that I knew that there weren't a lot of Black people, especially in the city of Milwaukee, who were practicing yoga, you know, I can't start out, you know, offering a yoga class at $15 or $20 per class, right? Like, how do you convince somebody to give something a shot if they don't necessarily know or see the value in it? And it's also very expensive, right? And I just, you know, assume that whether I should have or not, that, you know, people would need a break, you know, they would need me to cut them some slack on the cost of a class. And so I made sure to set our prices low. We started out charging $10 for a yoga class. And then we've had one price increase in 6 years. And so now our classes are $12 each. And, I always continue to think about like my students and our mission and who I'm trying to serve when I think about pricing and things like that. But yeah, for sure, I didn't see myself really reflected, you know, in the practice a ton or at, you know, studios that I would visit here in Milwaukee and other places too.
Well, and you talked about the woman with the natural hair, the Black woman who you studied from that you didn't give enough credit to, and it must have been good for you to see that representation. What kind of feedback are you getting with your own students in terms of how they're receiving the yoga and the representation in yoga?
Some of our students have practiced other places before, giving yoga a shot before, and there were just like little things that happened at the studio that made them feel unwelcome. You know, things that, you know, the teacher or the studio owner may not even have been aware of or thought of, right? And so they come into this Black owned and operated yoga studio and immediately feel at ease or maybe even at home because they can look around and they see people that look like them, you know, that talk like them. They see a variety of shapes, you know, and so it takes away that aspect of things, right? For people who wanted to practice yoga but didn't, you know, really feel welcome in a predominantly white studio. And, you know, I've had newer students who come in like, you know, I've been looking for, you know, like a Black yoga teacher. I didn't even know, you know, you existed or, you know, that there were other Black yoga teachers in Milwaukee. So when they find us, it's almost like this sense of like disbelief and relief, you know, that we actually exist. But yeah, that's been the experience of a lot of our students.
And what are some of the mental and physical wellness tools that you're getting good feedback on?
They speak most often about like the physical benefits, and normally we have this conversation once they've taken a break, right? So they started out and they were super committed, and then maybe they took a break for a few weeks or a few months, and they come back and they're like, I can tell the difference, right? Like sometimes there needs to be space or an absence for you to really realize, you know, the value in some things. For some people, it happens quicker than that. And for some people, it's, you know, how they are able to respond to their loved ones or how their loved ones respond to them after they start a practice. I've had quite a few people who've told me that their family members are like, you need to go back to yoga. Like if they've been gone, like they can tell the difference. Or like husbands who like their wives better when they're like practicing yoga on a regular basis because I guess maybe they're more relaxed at home. I'm not sure. You know, so those are the type of stories I hear the most. Stories I would like to start hearing, though, are the ways in which a yoga practice supports somebody like mentally and emotionally and spiritually, right? And that's not to say the physical benefits aren't important, you know, but I think there's so much more that the practice has to offer. And I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of that, you know, probably certainly at yoga studios, you know, around this country, but certainly at Embody Yoga too.
Do you have any special news going forward or special events or places where people can access your yoga studio? And is it open to, you know, specific audiences or can anyone come? How is that going to work out?
Yeah, so we are back open. Right now we're still requiring masks in studio, but I believe that will change at some point in July. We have also limited capacity in studio, but that will probably also change soon too. We do welcome anybody in, right? Like, I am very clear about why I started Embody Yoga and who I started it for, but it doesn't feel right to me in my heart or in my spirit to tell any particular group of people that they can't come or that they're not welcome, right? I don't want to maybe hurt people in the way that I've been hurt or in the way that my community has been hurt. That's, you know, just kind of the way I see it. And so we don't block anybody from coming and joining us in practice. We offer multiple classes throughout the week, as most yoga studios do. But one series or program that I'm really excited about is our residency at the Milwaukee Art Museum. They are starting programming called Lakeside at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And so it's an opportunity for people to engage with the art museum, I believe, using their words, in a low stakes way, right? And being outside. And so we will be teaching a class there weekly in their grassy area behind the museum, facing the lake, every Saturday at 11 a.m. with the exception of holiday weekends. So I'm really excited about that residency and that partnership. And the great thing about it is that it's, you know, it's accessible. It's a free class happening every week and it's family friendly. So kids are welcome to come too.
Joanna Brooks of Embody Yoga, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and everything you're doing in the community.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed this talk.
Joanna Brooks is the owner of Embody Yoga. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. You can find more information about her studio and the classes at the Milwaukee Art Museum at WUWM.com. Harley-Davidson culture has made its way from Milwaukee to just about everywhere around the globe. Now the culture it's created elsewhere has returned home to the Harley-Davidson Museum. The museum has an exhibit on Alfonso Sotomayor Canales, a Mexican stunt rider who became famous for his Salto de la Muerte, or Jump of Death. The bike that carried Sotomayor to fame is now on display at the museum, which gave Ann Sinfield an excuse to look into the history of Harley-Davidson in Mexico. Sinfield is the exhibits manager at the museum, and she spoke with Ben Benversi at the museum earlier this year about the bike, its rider, and the legacy of stunt riding in Mexico.
Can you take us back to the beginnings of Harley's entrance into Mexico and tell us a little bit about when and how that happened and what Harley looked like when it was in Mexico?
Sure, and I can start that story with the Mexican Revolution. It's a period of 10 years from 1910 to 1920 in Mexico. That's a period of just huge disruption in the country. A lot of political strife, a lot of dislocation among people, a lot of violence actually throughout the country. But it's at the same time that Harley's getting started here in Milwaukee. So Harley gets started in 1903. In the teens, during that same period as the revolution in Mexico, they are focused on international kind of customers. So they are very early in their life. So in the 19 teens, already kind of sending motorcycles and marketing and having dealers established all over the globe.
Wow.
Mexico is one of the places that they're getting established. So even in this period of just huge disruption in Mexico, by 1913, there's two dealers in Mexico, one in Guadalajara and one in Chihuahua. So, you know, it's a difficult time in Mexico, but I think it speaks to the love of motorcycling. You know, from the very early years, people are really interested in riding. So,
yeah. What did Harley culture look like in Mexico? Did it take on a different flavor than the United States?
We were lucky to work with an archive in Mexico City. It's an archive of a Mexican photographer, Vicente Cortez Sotelo. And he really is a character, really fascinating life. He started as a young man, like 17 years old, fighting in the Mexican Revolution. He becomes a photographer, a cameraman, a filmmaker, a motorcycle rider, stunt performer. 20 years, he's part of the Mexico City Transit Police. He travels all over the country photographing. And so we have this really great record of motorcycles and motorcycle culture within the transit police in Mexico City from the 20s from this Mexican photographer, Vicente Cortez. So not only were they transit or traffic police officers, they were stunt performers, and so they would perform all over the country. So they're still around, which is, you know, that's pretty impressive. That's a really long run. So I think they were kind of instrumental in kind of spreading that popularity of motorcycling in Mexico.
Uh-huh. I saw on some of the pictures from Cortez that you can see the bar, the famous Harley-Davidson sign.
Yeah.
Pretty early on in some of their pictures.
Yeah.
I wonder what sort of cachet that held for people in Mexico, because especially mm-hmm. here in Milwaukee, like people know what that means. And I wonder what sort of reputation it had for those people in Mexico.
I think it had a similar reputation. You know, the photograph you're talking about, I think, is the stunt performer, Jose Camarena. He was a pretty famous stunt performer in Mexico. He's in this really dramatic pose. There's a crowd of people behind him, two Harley Davidsons behind him. And two of the guys in the crowd are wearing white sweaters, and they have the bar and shield on their sweaters. And the photo's probably from, 1926, 1927. And to me, that seems really early to have that kind of brand identity, in a way, is how we would talk about it today, right? Have that really prominently worn and prominently kind of shown. But it's a group of stunt performers, and I think that identity has always, you know, been really strong.
Yeah. So the bike that we're looking at right here, yes, and that forms the new addition to the museum's collection from Alfonso Sotomayor. Can you tell us a little bit about the bike and the man who made the bike famous?
Sure. So this bike came into the archives collection in the fall of 2020. So it's relatively new to the museum. We were contacted by the family who were interested in working with us to bring this material here. The bike came with some other material. You see on the display the kind of leather riding suit, probably from the 1970s. There's some other clothing that came, some trophies. So Alfonso Sotomayor was a Mexican motorcyclist. He started racing in the 1930s. He had a very long career, racer, stunt performer. He's listed as a deceased member of this International Confederation of Motorcycle Officers, basically. So he was involved or connected with the motorcycle police in Mexico City. In the 1960s, he retired from racing, and he started performing this jump that he became really well known for, and he performed it all around the world. And he called it the Salto de la Muerte. It's the jump of death.
Yeah.
Let me explain what it is, and you'll understand it. So it's a short ramp. It's about 20 feet long, but it's only about 16 or 18 inches high, right? So it's pretty short. And what he does is get volunteers from the audience to lay down at the end of that ramp. And then he takes this 1957 Harley-Davidson Model FL and jumps it all over all those people.
Uh-huh.
He worked up to having like 47 people laying down at the end of his ramp. So he performed this jump internationally. He retired from riding completely in the late 70s and passed away in the mid-1980s. His entire family were riders and performers and racers. One of his sons is in the Hall of Fame in Mexico, but Alfonso was the first motorcyclist inducted into the Mexican Motorcycling Hall of Fame. But his whole family, they continue to ride and continue to race. Children and grandchildren.
Uh-huh. So he's left a legacy of riders in his stead.
Yeah, definitely. Some interesting things about this bike. So 1957 FL, it's a big, heavy bike, especially when you think of jumping it. But some things have been changed on it to make it a little bit lighter. So, for example, there's no electrical system on it. So the battery, the coil, the generator, all of that's been removed. And in its place, there's a vertical magneto for starting or for ignition. So that helps a little bit with the weight. And then the bike is decorated with, like the gas tank has flags from countries from all over. And it's got, on the other side, it's got some city names of different places he performed from all over the world. And then on the oil tank here towards the back of the bike, it's actually got names listed. These are individuals' names. They're transit police officers. So he's listed their names and the symbols of their ranks. And they're on both sides of the oil tank.
So what is the legacy of people like Sotomayor and those transit police officers today in Mexico with respect to Harley culture?
The group still performs. The legacy that any of these stunt performing groups bring, I think, is really that absolute love of motorcycling and that complete enjoyment and fun with the sport. So if you go through the off-road exhibit that we just opened, that's really about the history of Harley-Davidson and how riders always use these bikes in ways that the company never imagines, right? They take these bikes everywhere in all different conditions, and they've been doing that since the very early years of the company. And this, I think, is related to that. You know, some people ride off-road, some people jump over 47 people lying on the ground, right? It's just a way of pushing yourself and having fun and just really, it's about the love of motorcycling.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, thank you, Anne, for taking time to show me the bike and talk about it on Lake Effect.
Anytime. Thank you so much for coming down.
Anne Sinfield is the exhibits manager at the Harley-Davidson Museum. She spoke with Ben Benversi in April. You can find videos of the Jump of Death, archival photos of Mexican Harley riders, and information about visiting the museum at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 10 minutes, the latest installment of our Bubbler Talk series explores one of Milwaukee's favorite pizzas. But first, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton will talk about this week's impending full moon. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This week, there will be an unusual full moon. The Earth will be sitting right between the sun and moon, creating a line that will completely illuminate the moon in the night sky. The full moon symbolizes many things in different cultures, from time to religious and spiritual significance. There are even ongoing studies into how the moon can influence our minds and bodies. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share her own perspective on the importance of the full moon. Creighton begins by describing some things to look for.
So I think what you will notice is that there are two kinds of terrains on the moon. There is a darker, what we call mare, which means to see in Latin, which is darker and smoother. And then you see the areas, what's called the highlands, that are brighter and even to the naked eye, clearly more cratered. Now, it's a common idea that people have that, oh, well, the moon is full, bring out the telescope, bring out the binoculars. But in fact, it's easier to look at the moon for extended periods of time if it's not so bright. And when it's not full, there are more shadows, there's more crispness to the features. So I would argue that a first quarter or a third quarter would actually be easier, and you can really settle in and look at it with the telescope or binoculars, actually even better, to see more features, more of these craters and things on the moon.
So, you know, encouraging people not to look directly into a full moon with binoculars or a telescope, what other things will be in the night sky? If people do have these things out and want to look for something that are in the sky along with that full moon.
Sure. So you will look for something like Venus, which will set at around 10 o'clock And that means it's nicely visible. And the nice thing about Venus is that it's super, super bright. In fact, often people confuse Venus with an airplane. So my suggestion there is if the airplane moves, it's an airplane. If the airplane stays still, it's Venus. So that will be in the west. We also have Mars. Mars is going to be visible until about 10:30 or so, and it's reasonably well visible. And Jupiter is going to be starting to be visible at around 11:40 p.m., which I realize for some of our listeners, that's going to be too late. But Jupiter has something special. I'll get to Jupiter in a moment. I just want to say while we're at it that Saturn is also going to be visible at around 10:50 or so p.m. Saturn has a beautiful ring, which is gorgeous with a modest telescope, a good pair of binoculars. Coming back to Jupiter, may I geek out here a little bit, Audrey?
Yeah, because from what I understand, I think Jupiter is famous for its own moon system, right? Can we call it that? What's the technical term here?
Yeah. That's what we call it. Yep. So the first person who saw moons that we know of, who saw moons around Jupiter was Galileo. That's why they're called also Galilean moons. And there are four of them. Let's see, Europa, Io, Callisto, and Ganymede. Those are the four moons in no particular order. So what's cool about this? So imagine this guy uses a telescope and he looks at Jupiter and he sees these little dots. And he doesn't make much of it. Well, maybe I saw an extra star or whatever. But then he observes Jupiter night after night after night, and the dots move around, but they move around with Jupiter. So he concludes, oh, those are moons of Jupiter, which means there's at least something in the universe that is not going around the Earth. This was a big deal, because until then, at least if you're sitting in your backyard and you're looking in the sky, it looks like basically everything around you goes together, moves as if we're in the center of everything and everything is just rotating around us, revolving, I should say, around us. And this was one of the few clues that said, wait a second, that can't be the whole story. There's at least something that's going around Jupiter. And this was a major shift. This was sort of the beginning of that shift. No, the Earth is not the center of everything. The Sun is at the center of the solar system. And that, you know, is a philosophical big moment for our understanding of where we fit in the scheme of things.
And the moon also kind of shows us what is in our own backyard, what's in front of us, and how this past year and a half, it really highlights to appreciate what's always been accessible. And I feel like learning a little bit more about the moon could be a nice way to do that, especially in the summer.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people find surprising is that the moon appears at different places in the sky, appears, rises, sets at different times. I think a lot of people have this notion that the moon is up at nighttime, always. And if you just do a little experiment on your own, like, okay, let's just look for the rising of the moon, you realize that it changes pretty dramatically, you know, an hour or so every day from day to day. And the fact that you saw it there today doesn't mean it's going to be there tomorrow at the same time. In fact, it means it won't be. And for somebody like me who looks at the moon quite a bit, you realize that if you do spend the time to slow down a little bit and watch it day in and day out, you see the subtle differences. You see the changes. This changes in color, depends on the quality of the air on any given time, how low or how high it is at any given moment. I think that watching, say, for example, for the moonrise is very pretty. So you can easily search for, you know, when does the moon rise on a given day. It'll tell you what time that happens. And then if you live, say, for example, close to the lake or someplace where you have a clear eastern horizon, I have enjoyed now in the pandemic a few moon rises And I'd argue they're almost as pretty as a sunrise. And they're different. They're not the same from day to day. So I would just encourage people to take advantage of nature and celebrate the beauty of the moon and celebrate the beauty of our own planet. The more we learn about the cosmos, the more we understand the urgency of protecting our own planet, our special home.
Most definitely. Well, Jean, thank you so much.
Thank you, Audrey. This is, as always, a pleasure.
Jean Creighton is our astronomy contributor, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Creighton will be leading a full moon hike at the Urban Ecology Center through Riverside Park on June 23rd. All ages are welcome, and you can find out more information and a link to register at wuwm.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Audrey Nowakowski, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, listener Greg Chinachinsky is curious about Milwaukee's favorite pizza toppings, cheese, sausage, mushroom, and onion. Now, is CSMO or sausage special or however you order it really our favorite? While I can only rely on my taste buds to confirm, I did reach out to some other experts on the topic, like food writer Ann Christensen of Milwaukee Magazine.
I do think it probably is the most popular, but I don't have any numbers to back me up except to say every place I go to, that seems to be a staple of their menu.
Why? Christensen says that CSMO simply goes well together.
First of all, onion, you get that little bit of bite on the pizza, just give you a little bit of a burst of flavor. Obviously, the creamy cheese, the sausage with a little bit of fresh fennel in it, which again, you do that. Gives you a little bit more flavor to the sausage. And then mushroom. And interestingly enough, there's some old school Milwaukee restaurants that would put canned mushroom on their pizza.
There are a few theories as to why this combination is so popular here, and Christensen believes it's an offshoot of Milwaukee's Italian heritage.
You know, if you think about some of the pizzerias that have grown and popped up, near the Brady Street area where a lot of Italian immigrants settled, and where we have an Italian grocery store, Gloriosos, where they make sausage. And there have been other small little butcher shops, Italian-owned, that make their own sausage. I think that's where it comes from.
Speaking of pizzerias, I called around to see if they could confirm that CSMO is one of the most popular pizzas.
My name is Leanne Grano. I'm the owner of Ned's on South 27th Street.
So is cheese, sausage, mushroom, and onion Milwaukee's favorite?
I would have to say yes, maybe with or without the onion, but sausage, mushroom is definitely, I think, Milwaukee's signature topping pizza of choice.
Ned's Pizza has been in business on Milwaukee's south side since 1969, and Grano says it's been a standard menu item since the beginning. She thinks its popularity has something to do with Milwaukee's German and Polish heritage.
You know, a lot of German people, with Usingers and Bratwurst and all sorts of types of different sausage and Polish sausage and everything. So I would think that, yeah, it probably has something to do with it because we sell a lot more sausage pizzas than we do pepperoni, and pepperoni is quite popular.
Grano says that Ned's goes through mushrooms like crazy.
We go through, I'd say, at least three times, maybe four times as many mushrooms as we do black olives or onions. Definitely way more than green peppers. Green pepper is like a polarizing pizza topping. Either you love them or you hate them.
So we call it cheesemo. It is, very common. Before we got on, I just Googled CSMO to see if it is more widespread. And I didn't see, I think I saw medical terminology. I don't know how far, it goes beyond Milwaukee, but it's definitely a thing here in Milwaukee.
That's Pizza Man co-owner CJ Krofcheck. His theory on the popularity of the pizza is because, well, we like cheap food.
I think in Milwaukee, we tend to still kind of take to the cues of our ancestors. And some of what our ethnic food is based on here in Milwaukee is what is both delicious and inexpensive. And, there is so much food that is kind of derived from peasant roots. And I think the same can be said for our pizza choices.
He says these flavor-packed toppings are Pizza Man's most popular combination.
If you're pushing out 80 or 100 pizzas a night, you're probably looking at 20 or so that are going to be cheese.
So whether it's the Italian, German, or Polish heritage in Milwaukee, or because we like a good deal, all of these theories still point to a delicious flavor combination. So take this as a sign to order and enjoy a cheese, sausage, mushroom, and onion pizza.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
You can hear more of our Bubbler Talk series at wuwm.com. Last week, we learned about the history of the Up and Under Club on Brady Street. And this season, we've also learned about one of the earliest Mexican restaurants in the city and the story behind the Gandhi statue at the Milwaukee County Courthouse. You can submit your own questions and hear more Bubbler Talk stories at wuwm.com. And Bubbler Talk wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with local LGBTQ health specialist, Dr. Jessica Francis, for this month's Fit for You. Plus, we'll learn about the Milwaukee organization Diverse and Resilient and their mission to achieve health equity and improve safety for LGBTQ people. That's all tomorrow at 10 right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.